All righty. Thank you, Dr. Erson, and thank you for the APHA Medical Care Section for having me here today. Title of my presentation today is Optimizing the Use of Antimicrobials in Human Medicine and Model Stewardship Programs. I have no disclosures. Following the presentation, I hope that you're able to discuss the rationale for optimizing antimicrobials in human medicine, to describe current susceptibility and utilization surveillance efforts at the local level, and to illustrate a model for stewardship programs at the local hospital level. Nearly all experts agree that bacterial and viral diseases will have been virtually wiped out. This is actually a quote from Time magazine in 1966 in a set of articles entitled The Futurists Looking Towards the Year 2000, in which they ask experts to predict what life might be like in the 21st century. They also said that cardiac disease would have been eliminated and cancer would be no longer a thing that we'd have to deal with. Clearly they missed the boat on this one, or we wouldn't all be sitting in here talking about this today. So why is the prudent use of this valuable resource we have in antibiotics so important? Well, to start, infections caused by resistant microorganisms lead to worse outcomes. They lead to attributable mortality of about 6.5%, increased lengths of stay by a week to almost 2 weeks, increased attributable medical costs of anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 per patient, and also significant societal costs. Excuse me. In addition, we know that our ever-increasing uses of antimicrobials is also increasing rates of resistance. If we look on this chart, we can see how seasonal fluctuations in the use of aminopenicillin, such as ampicillin or amoxicillin, actually influences rates of resistance. If we look along the x-axis on the bottom, we see January through December. On the y-axis on the left side of the screen is your aminopenicillin use. That's measured in the blue kind of valley, if you will, on the chart. And on the y-axis on the right, you see E. coli resistance rates. So you see on the winter months, so October through about April, we see high usage of aminopenicillins. Why is that? Well, it's upper respiratory tract infection season. What we see, unfortunately, is a corresponding spike in resistance rates for ampicillin to E. coli. We see, and it unfortunately also lags behind. So we see a definitive correlation there between the use of an antimicrobial and the development of resistance. Now, what I'm not going to talk a lot about today, but we've kind of touched on already, is inappropriate use of antimicrobials. And a lot of this in the winter months is inappropriate use of antimicrobials for viral illnesses. So there's kind of a twofold thing here. Here we have increasing utilization of a drug, but we also have inappropriate utilization of drug contributing to resistant infections, which we know contribute to worse outcomes and higher costs. Compounding the issue of increasing utilization and increasing cost is the so-called drying up of the antimicrobial pipeline. Sulfonamides were introduced in the 1930s or were discovered in the 1930s. Aminoglycosides and beta-lactams in the 40s and kind of the golden age of antimicrobial discovery with chloramphenicol, the tetracyclines, macrolides and glycopeptides in the 50s, streptogramins, quinolones, not fluoroquinolones, but quinolones, and lincosamides in the 60s, and then trimethoprim in the 70s. Then we really didn't see a novel mechanism of action antibiotic come around until the 2000s with the lipopeptides and oxidolaviones. Though the 1970s, 80s, and 90s were not devoid of new antimicrobial discovery. This is where we saw the advent of broad-spectrum penicillins, broad-spectrum cephalosporins, and the carbapenem class, but not necessarily a novel mechanism of action. And broadly speaking, our development of new novel antimicrobials just simply has not kept pace with the advent of resistance. And this decline of drug discovery is quite staggering when we compare it against anti-neoplastic or immunomodulating agents. We can see if we just look at the last three decades, 1980 to 89, 1990 to 99, and 2000 to 2009, we see total approved antibiotics 29, 23, and 9 for antibiotics. But that's not the important column. That middle column is the most important. What was actually marketed? Only half, on average, of those drugs. And if we look at this in direct comparison to antineoplastic and immunomodulating agents, you can see they're kind of coming into their own. They're coming into a golden age. And it's kind of an interesting paradox if you think about it, because antineoplastic agents are not that different than an antibiotic. Both are intended to kill something. They're intended to rid the body of an infection, or to rid the body of, I know, a rogue cell. Yet we see a distinctly different path in the development of discovery that in and of itself could be a panel to discuss. Excuse me. Finally, and perhaps maybe the most important, for better or for worse, is legal and regulatory issues are forcing us to optimize and use our antimicrobials in a prudent and judicious fashion. The Deficit Reduction Act of 2006 eliminates the payment for several types of infections that are acquired during a hospital stay or acquired in a nosocomial way. This includes catheter-associated urinary tract infections and vascular catheter-associated infections, so-called CAUTIs and CLABSIs, in addition to other surgical sites of infection. And this is only going to continue over the next several years as more of these are built in with CMS coming more online with these. California Senate Bill number 739 mandates the process for the judicious use of antibiotics in general acute care facilities, and I'm not going to go into this because this is going to be covered by our next speaker in great detail. How antibiotics are assessed in terms of their usage and how we produce surveillance at the local level really varies wildly. Our ability to do this on a national scale is improving through a variety of things. Benchmarking is recently becoming more available, allowing us to do both internal and external benchmarking, which is a huge benefit to us, but it's not something we've always been able to do. And previous speakers have talked about there's challenges with this in the veterinary and animal industries, and there's certainly the same challenges we have in the human side of things. And like all things, resources matter. Do you have electronic medical records at your facility that allows you to quickly, efficiently assess where you are, what you're using, how you're using it, and who you're using it in? Do you have surveillance software that can help augment that electronic medical records and can give you the real-time data you need to make the changes if you see something, an outbreak pop up, or you think, oh, gee, I think I'm seeing a resistance trend move in this direction? And finally, do you have the team necessary to implement all this? I mean, you can have the best system in the world, but if you don't have the bodies that are able to do it, it becomes very, very difficult. And really, the goals of these programs, of an antimicrobial stewardship program, are fourfold. We want to improve patient outcomes. That's why we are all here. We want to improve patient safety. We want to reduce antimicrobial resistance and reduce healthcare costs, but some of these are easier to benchmark and measure than others. It's pretty easy for us to benchmark and measure our reduction in healthcare cost with the use of a stewardship team. We can look at this year I use this much antimicrobial cost-wise, and this year I use this much. Looking at and benchmarking whether or not your stewardship team had an impact on antimicrobial resistance is much more difficult because it's going to depend a lot on your hospital. It's going to depend on the type of patients that you see. Do you have a hospital that has a bone marrow transplant unit, or do you see a lot of cancer patients, or are you a level one trauma center that's accepting a lot of patients of very high acuity with long hospital stays? Those are going to influence your resistance, and it's harder to prove that your stewardship program is having good benefit there. The stewardship team should really be made up of four primary components: a physician, a pharmacist, a clinical microbiologist, and an infection preventionist. And this is out of ICHI in 2012. I believe it was in April that this edition came out. Within this team, at least one of the members should have specific training in antimicrobial stewardship, and members can fulfill more than one role. Your physician could also be your hospital's clinical microbiologist or infection preventionist. Additionally, other members of the team that can be helpful would include a hospital epidemiologist, and if you have those surveillance software, if you have medical records, you could also add in your information technology folks. They can be super helpful here. Consensus by this team is critical to moving initiatives forward, to provide a united and strong front for other healthcare providers as you go about changes, which can sometimes be very dramatic in a healthcare system. The core principles of stewardship, one of these two methodologies is usually going to be kind of the foundation of your stewardship program. The first would be prospective audit with intervention and feedback. And really, this is the provision of written or verbal information or recommendations to prescribers based upon patient-specific characteristics, such as microbiological data or local resistance patterns. It could also be information regarding clinical literature or recommendations to augment a dose or a length of therapy. The benefits of this type of approach is that you will see a decrease to the patient and to the hospital. It can help facilitate IV to PO conversion, easing and improving discharge planning, getting our patients out of the hospitals quicker, reducing their exposure to infections, which we know we can easily transmit within the healthcare system. You can also provide education to your physicians at the point of contact, perhaps training them so that in the future when they see this type of infection, they might go right to the pathway that you wanted them to do initially. Barriers, this is a super labor-intensive process. Achieving buy-in can sometimes be difficult, and it doesn't stop initially inappropriate prescribing. You're kind of going retrospectively with this process. Whereas the formulary restriction and pre-authorization process is more like a large barrier than the speed bump I just described. Formulary restriction basically is just that. You're placing limits on how ordering can occur. It can be non-orderable, or it can be orderable only in a specific unit or for a specific patient population. Pre-authorization is kind of a fancy term for prior approval. We've probably all dealt with that in the community pharmacy setting when you wanted to use one agent and another, and you know your entrant said you needed to use another one. We can do the same thing in the healthcare setting. The benefit of this approach is it is definitively the most effective process for reducing costs. It is the most definitive way to control usage. What we don't know is if it clearly benefits antimicrobial resistance, and it can lead to unintended consequences. If you have, I use this example when I'm teaching students, you can kind of have the squeezing the balloon effect when you're dealing with pre-authorization and formulary restriction. If you've all seen a clown shaping a balloon, he squeezes the balloon and air goes into a certain thing. If we hone down in on one specific type of antimicrobial class and we say, everyone, you should use this one and not this one, we can put a lot of pressure on one specific class of antimicrobial, and that can have unintended effects. You can also be seen as a police state when you're kind of telling a physician or a prescriber what they can and cannot do. And that can also lead to some difficult interactions. Supplemental strategies you can use in addition to those core strategies, which would include education, clinical guidelines and pathways, cycling of antimicrobials or scheduled switches, such as if you have a ventilator-associated pneumonia pathway, antimicrobial order forms, dose optimization, so using appropriate doses for specific infections, assessing whether patients can need continued broad-spectrum therapy. Do they still need combination therapy? And conversion from parenteral to oral therapy. I've been a part of multiple antimicrobial stewardship programs, some in development, some already developed, and kind of some lessons you can take away whether you're at an academic medical center that's in the middle of an urban downtown setting, or if they're a veterans hospital, or even where I am now developing in a community-type hospital that's definitely not an academic center, is obtaining buy-in for any type of stewardship initiative is important. You engage your key administrators and medical personnel early. But don't just engage those people. Engage the practitioners who are in the trenches, who will be directly affected by any changes that you make. It's really critical you get all those people on board so that when you're making these changes, when you're trying to get these initiatives moved forward in order to help your overall patient population, it's not just an edict coming down from high. Not all antimicrobial stewardships are created equal. Find what works for your institution. The mix of personnel that you have, the types of resources that you have available are certainly going to be different at every institution. Find what works for you. Finally, know thyself, know thy hospital, know thy city, and know thy region. Okay? We sometimes in healthcare have this silo mentality that what happens in my facility is the only thing that I'm worried about. That my resistance patterns are the only thing that matters. Well, The fact is, we get patients from all over the place. We get patients from nursing homes. We get patients from other healthcare facilities. We get patients that come in from farms. I live in right outside of our town in Fort Wayne actually is a very heavy Amish farming community. We certainly receive a lot of patients from that. So know what's going on outside your facility. Go out and talk to the people in nursing homes and other hospitals and find out what kinds of problems are they dealing with, because there's a really good chance if they're close to you, they're probably dealing with similar problems. I leave you with this closing thought from Alexander Fleming in 1945. He said, "It's not difficult to make microbes resistant to penicillin in the laboratory by exposing them to concentrations not sufficient to kill them." The same thing has occasionally happened in the body. I'm afraid he was a little bit ahead of his time there when he was thinking about that. I think it's up to us in prudent use of antimicrobials to slow this process down. I'd like to thank Dr. Urson for having me here today, and thank you.